So I went to upstate New York this past weekend with my husband's family. And we said goodbye to my father-in-law. We did it in the coolest way.
Yeah.
We did not have a funeral. We did not gather at someone's house and invite all these people that like have not been a part of his life for a long time. So the last couple of years of his life, he had dementia. And so really the closest part of his family were the ones that kind of were part of his everyday life. So we just decided to say goodbye and go spend the weekend in some of all of his favorite places. So we are all from upstate New York, which makes it kind of fun. So we did things like kayaking in the creek, that like he went kayaking in.
Yeah.
You know, we went hiking up this famous place. I'm saying famous because we're from the smallest town of Schoharie. Roman's, called Roman's Nose. It's like beautiful. And we went up there. We went up there together. We went to his old family farm and we spread his ashes actually in one of the fields where the horses are. We just did the whole weekend. I couldn't have actually like planned a more, first of all, upstate New York in the summer.
Beautiful.
But just wanted to say, this is just a funny observation. The other thing we did was we went to the bar in our town. Now, our town is one street. So there's not even a stoplight. So it's just one street. And it's called the Glass Bar. Okay? The Glass Bar. And in that bar, pretty much are the people who walk to the bar, who are from the village, and they, I feel like they start maybe at 1 o'clock and they all sit around the bar and they know each other. Everyone knows who they are. So when you come in and you're not like from there, well, we're from there, but we don't live there anymore.
Oh, they know you're not locals anymore.
Walking in the door.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. They like all turn their heads and look at us. And we played pool at the glass bar and we sat there and it was just super, super fun. But I want to tell you something. It's actually kind of a famous bar. And I cannot remember the year, but remember David Letterman? On his show, he went to the glass.
Oh, nice.
He went to the glass bar.
I could see him at that. I mean, especially his more current show. I could see him hanging out there.
And this was his like, and he went there because he was doing this like series of let's go to the bars that no one in the world would ever go to. It was kind of one of those. And because we are a little town in upstate New York that... For anyone who listens in Schoharie.
Well, that's like my goal. Where we live, I don't know why. I've thought forever, like, I just want to have that place. It's just your go-to. You don't have to think, like, where do I want to go?
Yeah.
If there's a game on or you just need to chill or you're meeting someone, there's just that place.
That place.
And when you walk in, they've, like, already got their your order for you. It's like, I'll have the huge. But I knew you guys were going to different places, but I didn't know I didn't know the why. That's really cool.
It was a great weekend.
That idea of how to remember someone and kind of...
So we remembered him and also had a blast.
Yeah.
So I felt like, man, what a great way for us to just celebrate the life of someone. And none of us would be here if it weren't for him. And so we were like, let's...
You know, the other thing I like about that is it... It feels like a way to actually help grieving. I'm curious if it did or not for you guys, because... Since you're doing those activities, it kind of probably naturally brought up different stories and memories versus when you're just sitting around and you've got me thinking about times where I've experienced loss and you kind of, no one knows what to say or it's hard to bring stuff up. You don't really know where to go with it.
It was probably a little more natural because
Was it?
Yeah, because I think there were stories that were told throughout the entire weekend more naturally instead of so forced.
Yeah.
And then we definitely had this one moment where we did hire someone to put together a video of his whole life, you know, from the day he was born, you know, all of his pictures. And it was also nice to have one formal moment where we watched and we all did cry and we had a good cry. But it was a great release. I think, I mean, he died in May. So we waited a long time to do this this way.
Yeah.
And I think all of his children, including me, as even though I'm daughter-in-law, needed this something to say, okay, to like let go of the grief of it's time to say goodbye. But it was beautiful. It was so cool.
Yeah.
It was a great weekend. Like, you're welcome.
Coaching shout out. I was going to make up, you know, sometimes like we make up different names to protect confidentiality.
Right.
I was going to make up a name and I'm like, I'm just blank. So this person, this individual of interest, did shout out to them because they did a post-it note hack like you shared on the podcast recently.
Yeah.
For their mindset shift. This was cool because it wasn't a practical tip, but they put it on their laptop, they put it on their mirror in the bathroom at home, and on the back of their phone which actually turned into a piece of duct tape so it would stay because he said, that's where I'll always see it. So anyway, did it for a mindset. And the mindset shift was something, I forget the exact words that he used. You know, he was writing his message to himself was like, I don't need to make a decision now. Like, hold off on the decision for now and just explore. Oh, that was it. Hold off on the decision for now and just explore. And this is why, because this happens a lot for people where he had the voices in his head of his dad, his friends, his colleagues, his boss, all the expectations of everyone, what they thought he should be and do in life. And he's realizing he's actually cut out for something totally different than the track he's currently on. And so when we started the exploration process, he's immediately knee-jerking back towards like, I just need a job that's like the same thing. I just need to like, and he has these moments of kind of going, I just need, let me just like get something right now. He wants to revert back to what's comfortable, what he's used to, a job that's similar, but he knows he wants something different and needs something different. So there's this mindset shift of like, it's okay. It's okay to chill for a minute and explore other options. And you don't have to make a decision right now. Funny enough, in that very session, he realized like entrepreneurship was actually his favorite path option, but he had never given himself the permission to explore it. But it was in there. So
holding off on the decision.
Yeah, I love
that. And I think the key thing here is that sometimes we might say something like that in the coaching session, but we divert back to not keeping that mindset. By writing it down, it makes you kind of hold to it just a little bit more.
Yeah. I like that. Love you put it. He took your advice to the next level. He's like, I'm putting it in three places. My gripe is that personalities tend towards like, okay, you mentioned the J or the P on the Myers-Briggs.
I did.
This is where I'm going. The J, I have a lot of gripes about J's because I'm a P, so sorry, J's. Right. I'm going to be griping about you all the time. Is they want to categorize things. There's a need to kind of put a label on things or to know which bucket is it in, this or that. And it's funny, it's an ongoing joke between me and Ashley because she's so confused and sometimes just laughs sometimes that like in a conversation, I can just be okay with not having the conclusion of it or the opinion on it. And she's like, you're actually okay just sitting there with that question, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah. I'm not saying that's great, but the J needs that closure of like, but is it good or bad?
Is it good or bad?
Okay. So this is to me fascinating because people in the P camp don't realize that like there are people out there needing the definition.
Yep.
But even more so, people in the J camp are just baffled that you could be okay sitting there in the unknown space.
Unknown. Not because, labeled at all.
Yeah. And so, okay, here my gripe is around like, is someone nice or not nice? Yeah. I'm curious if you've ever noticed this. Lately, I've been noticing after especially like a first interaction or any kind of social setting, I'm going to just kind of whatever. I'm going to stereotype, but the J's need to define, was that person nice or not nice, is like kind of often a thing. What I was thinking about is how often we're actually experiencing that person's personality in the social interaction, not whether they're nice or not. So what I mean is like somebody might be a people pleaser,
right?
Might have that strong in their personality. So in that first interaction, they're really, really going above and beyond to try and make sure like things are cool. We keep the peace, you know, you like me, they might be like going along with whatever I say just to kind of keep me happy. And so I leave and I go, man, that person's so nice. Let's assume you were there in the conversation. You were more open with your opinions. And so I leave going like, Sunday, she's not that nice. But that other guy, he was nice. And what is driving me crazy about it is it actually has nothing to do with who was nice or not nice. It's actually just like how their personality
came out in the conversation. How they were showing up.
It's a wrong judgment.
It is a wrong judgment because if you are, I know many people in my life who are very shy and can look not nice.
Right? But in the really interaction, nice. People walk away, but oh, she's so nice. Yep.
Or and not it's nice.
Inaccurate.
Yeah. Inaccurate.
No, I actually love Jace because I need him, but those things irk me because I'm like, What? No, no,
and
no.
And I would say that that's not even necessarily a Jay thing. I'd say that we're quick to make judgments based on how a person shows up sometimes. And that is not necessarily that first
But
piece.
I just want to pin it
but
on Jays.
But you
want to
pin it on the Jays. Okay. Jays. Those darn Jays.
Oh, man. Today's interview is interesting because we have Karen Eber. She had a TED Talk that got a few, like 2 million, I think, about 2 million views. And it was about how your brain responds to stories and why they're crucial for leaders. Mm-hmm. So she really comes at storytelling from, I would say, a more practical approach, like a more everyday you can actually use it approach, and B, from some of the more neuroscience research. And she's big into understanding how the brain works with stories. So she has a book coming out called The Perfect Story that kind of goes over more in depth her process. But she also is the founder of Eber Leadership, where she works with organizations and leaders like how we do, but more specifically on how to build and change culture via storytelling.
What I like about her interview today was that she talked about the framework and structure of storytelling. And she even did a little bit of coaching with you on how to pull your story out.
We make me look real bad. So, you know, you can hang around for that at least. No, it's good.
Yep. And then, but she also talks about her career journey a bit.
Yeah.
Around how she was, what was her first career? It was like instructional design.
Yeah. And she was at GE and Deloitte and, well, especially GE. She was part of the original, like, developing performance management as we know it today.
Oh, yes.
Part of that all the way to, like leaving
and
executive
being her
roles
own,
to starting your own business.
Yeah, fascinating.
It is. Well, we'll let her explain more. This is Karen Eber.
My current title is CEO and Chief Storyteller of Eber Leadership Group. And the first job I had was an instructional designer.
Oh, okay.
What is that?
What does that mean? Instructional designer.
It is not interior design. My decor at home would justify that it is not. It is where you look at really psychology applied towards adults and how they learn and how you are not only helping teach them in the best way possible, how you're creating the best environment for people to learn.
Nice. Was that a job right out of college or before that or what?
Right out of college. I actually got a master's in it. I did my bachelor's in psychology and communications and then went into a master's looking at this and how you improve performance and apply psychology to work. And then I went, did an internship and got a job.
Okay. And in terms of the future and going from here, are there any certain ambitions that you have in what you do?
Absolutely not.
Okay, good. Then we'll be good.
Whatever I imagined, like, changes, you know, I opened my business 5 years ago, and I feel like every quarter it evolves into something different. And where I am now, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have expected to be. So I don't have a vision, but I always do have goals and aspirations, but it's more being open to where there's energy to follow.
Yeah. How did you decide to go into instructional design? It's just, obviously, we know what it is because we're in this space, but it seems like such a specific niche thing.
Yeah, it's a fair question. I really enjoyed psychology, but I didn't want to focus on clinical practice or counseling. And I felt like there's still a way to apply it to how people do work without taking their problems home at night and probably getting into a place that's really dangerous for an empath. And instructional design fit in this place of you were doing all of those things, but in a really not clinical way. And the university I was at had the number one program in the world. And it was like, all right, well, I'm here. This is what my next step is. Let's do it. And it's definitely suited. I, I remember working on a shower for someone, like a wedding shower, and the person that was hosting it sent me this page long list of directions to their house. This was pre-Google Maps, and I remember like formatting it and editing it down into something really easy for people to follow. And I'm like, yeah, it's just always what I do. How do you help people consume what they need and get what's most helpful?
Yeah, I think it's cool because it's one of those spaces where a lot of times the way that in our world, like a workshop or a class is run, or even the way a meeting happens, it's just by accident. It's just kind of this, like, whatever happens when people get in the room versus having thought through and designed how it should flow and how it should feel and how the interactions should happen. And I know you were actually talking about, I think it was your work with GE, with some of that, like designing the behaviors, designing the interactions, which I love that topic, but I find it's a very, like, it's unknown to a lot of people that's even a thing.
But what you described is really almost my career path. So I started in this place of designing and developing training. And then you step back and you realize, like, not everything is a training solution. Sometimes it's communications or putting policies in place or changing the environment. And then you quickly realize, well, the leaders play a big role in this too. So how do we set expectations for leaders and develop them? And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And it made me recognize that from the point where people are hired into an organization all the way through, whether they retire or they leave, there's so many different things that you can impact. And so my focus just kept getting bigger and bigger. So when I got to GE, I was in a head of culture role in a business for 90,000 employees in 150 mm-hmm. countries, and they didn't need training. They needed ways to understand what was expected of them or where we were going and what that meant for them and how they could create a day-to-day on their teams that was enjoyable. And so I started to use storytelling because it's an easy way for people to hear something and think about, what does this mean for me and what do I want to do? You know, values are nice and all of those corporate things are nice, but it's not until an individual stops and thinks what they care about and what they want to do about it that anything changes. And so I found stories are a great way to do that. And when you use a story, you can sneak in the vegetables and give them some tools and some learning.
Were you always into storytelling, like, yourself?
Yes and no. I have always used it throughout my career because I was in these positions trying to influence organizations to make these investments. And maybe one or two people had the ability to say yes, and 98 had the ability to say no. And I would try to move things forward, and those 98 would be saying, we're not doing this. And it was really frustrating. So I found stories were a great way to slow the nose and get them on my side and have them help persuading. Or when I was trying to help leaders gain new insights or understanding, a story was a really quick way to change their thinking and help expand it. But I did, as a child, recognize that you can really change energy of an interaction with stories. And I should just tell that story. Does it all make more sense? You can see I'm doing the mental calculations of, do I go there? We're going to go there. I have two different color eyes. I have a brown eye and a green eye. And what started to happen around the age that I got to school is this thing that I absolutely loved about myself became the thing that was weird by everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Like, what do you mean it's weird? I would notice in conversation, the person I was talking to, their words would, like, come to a halt, and I see their eyes going back and forth slowly, and I know what's coming. And they will just stop mid-sentence, and they'll usually say, oh, did you know you have two different color eyes?
Like, did you realize? Yeah. No.
Right. I mean, so then we're like, did you realize? Like, so sometimes I would play it along.
Could you imagine if you actually said to them, no,
that's what I would say. I would go, you're kidding, right? And then the next question or the next statement would almost always be, I know a dog that has that. To which I would be like, thank you. The third statement was almost always, you know, David Bowie, he had two different color eyes.
Oh gosh.
Which he did not. He had an accident that made his pupil dilated you're going through this thing and you're just getting more and more depleted. Mm-hmm. And then the questions would start. Well, first it would be like, hey, come here, you got to see her eyes. And all of a sudden,
now I got a crowd.
Come see this weirdo. There's something wrong with her. And And then it would be, you know, well, what color eyes do your parents have? And do you see different colors out of each eye? And like, just
they're trying to help. Now it's maybe trying to help.
But it was so bad. Like,
it is so bad. And yet as adults, that's cool. You're right. Even as adults, it's like, oh, that's really interesting and cool.
Yeah, no, this is from adults. Don't give adults a pass on this. This is adults. Are you doing this?
Oh, seriously?
This still happens today. Oh my gosh. Still happens. This is almost a script that I'm taking you through. That has happened so many times. And I got so discouraged because we all hopefully have something about ourselves that we love. And like, I always love this. You know, when you go to elementary school and you do your self-portrait, I'd always turn to the person next to me and say, which one's the brown one? Because I could never remember. And he would say this one. I would like lay on the paper and reach behind me and color me. And then my parents would go to back to school night and say, we saw your self-portrait. Like, of course you did. There was only one with two different color eyes. You could pick it out. Yeah. But I was just cool. Like, oh, yeah, you know, loved it. But this made me like just I hated these interactions. And one day I got really flippant and I said, well, I was born with brown eyes. And I was at home in my room coloring. And you know that big box of crayons that you have? You throw them all in, the broken ones, the peeled ones, the perfect ones. Mm-hmm. I was coloring and I was hungry. Dinner wasn't going to be for a few hours. So I picked up a green crayon and I sniffed it. And it didn't really smell like anything. But I took a bite of it and it tasted pretty good. So I ate it and I liked it. And I ate all the green crayons in the box. And the next day I woke up and my eye was green. And then I would sit and wait. And usually what happens is people look at me sideways, like, is she for real? Like, I can't tell if she's joking or if she's serious. Yeah. And I would eventually fess up that, no, I didn't eat crayons and that's not what happened. But it completely changed the energy. So we went from, you've got to see this, to like, they then start laughing. And they realize they asked me, did you know you have two different color eyes? And it like changed our interaction completely. And it created this connection and we would have a different conversation. I mean, to this day, 20, 30 years later, I had people saying they remember when they see they think of me when they see crayons. And so have I always told stories? Yeah, because that moment showed me there's this shift that you can create in energy and you can take what feels like an awkward conversation and create a different type of interaction, which is, I still use that story to this day and I still get the same responses, but it creates a shift that is just so helpful.
That is a really interesting story.
I feel like I have so many questions here about stories, though, because we work with a lot of corporate clients and they know this concept that storytelling is the buzz. Like, it's helpful. They know it helps. But they get stuck on things like my story or others' story, or do I create a story around the data? Like, there's so many. And then they say things like, well, what if I'm not a good storyteller?
Let's go through all of those. Yeah.
I know, right?
Because there's really some simple things to embrace. Because I get the same exact reactions, right? So the first fear is I don't want to have to tell something personal. There's things about my life that I don't care to share. Family, friends, hobby, like whatever. I don't want to do that. It feels very vulnerable. And I always tell people every story is personal, but personal doesn't mean private. So even if I'm telling a story about someone else, it's personal because of how I'm telling it and why I'm telling it. I'm bringing something to it that makes it personal, but I'm not revealing something that feels private. And I always say I have a pretty high privacy barrier. I don't tell stories about family, but I will gladly tell you a story about huge mistakes that I've made, because to me, that's not exposing, you know, that's not private. There's lessons in that. There's discussions. And so figuring out what is personal and private is different. You do not make up stories. People can sniff out a made up story. They feel manipulated. And so everyone's asking, like, should I make up a story? No, there are endless stories all around you. Even if it's not a story you've experienced, you can tell a story that you've observed or that you love. But make it your own, because it hasn't been told by you. And that's the point of it. A lot of people say, I'm not a good storyteller. And I'd say, well, you probably are, but in different settings. You probably aren't sitting at dinner with your friends in the middle of a story about a vacation adventure thinking, I'm the worst storyteller ever. Like, you're just telling it and you're having fun and you're laughing. somehow we think that doesn't translate to business, that we have to be like more put together. And it's not the case. It's the humanity that's important.
I think that translation is a really tough one for people, though. They think, you know how it is, even when you get in front of somebody maybe famous or like the big bad boss or something like that, you think all of a sudden their tone changes. They get really awkward and almost like not themselves. I feel like the same thing happens is they'll tell a story at dinner with their friends and it's super fun. And then they get corporate-y and then they no longer know how to tell a fun story.
And it's just
that's the same place I get hung up, but for a different reason, because the storytelling on stage or the storytelling in a meeting or with a purpose has to like teach something or has to like influence in a certain direction
just for fun.
Versus just telling you what happened yesterday is just telling you what happened. It doesn't have to evoke a certain result.
I disagree. I think that when you're telling the story with friends, there is an outcome, right? It's entertaining or laughing or whatever, but that the stakes for that feel a lot lower than the outcomes that you want in a different setting. For most people, they see a TED talk or they see someone do speaking and they're like, I can't do that. They make it look effortless. Sure, they practiced. They worked it through a process. I think that people can be storytellers once they recognize, once you learn a bit of the science of what's going on in your brain, you can really lean into that and apply it in your stories. That's going to translate to engaging the audience's brain more. And you can work through the steps to have confidence of, have I considered the different things that are going to be helpful? And it's a little slower the first couple times you do it, but you can get to the point where you're able to pull these things together fairly quickly and tell them in a way that feels natural to you. It's just most often people are told tell a story and then they don't know what to do and they don't see steps to guide them through, or they're using something like the hero's journey, which is great for fiction. But when you're trying to land an idea in the meeting, it's really hard to figure out, like, how do you back your idea into that?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I was most interested about you, your approach, your book, is that more practical. The way it hit me was just the more practical, real way of storytelling versus, anyone who's kind of latched onto the idea or learned a bit here or there or tried to implement storytelling. It's usually kind of the hero's journey, which I've also struggled with that. Trying to tell like my life's origin story in order to make some small point. I'm just curious, like when you work with people through this or when you, I don't know, walk me through that, maybe even how to shift that lens and what's the difference there?
The first thing is to recognize that your story always starts with the audience and not with the idea or the structure. And that is sometimes where we get stuck, because we hear a story or we have an experience that we want to share and we love, but we're focused on the story and not the audience. And every time you tell a story, you want to think about who you're telling it to, because you're going to tell it differently each time. So you want to think about, what is it that I want this audience to know or do differently after this story, this experience? What is it I want them to think or feel? Where are they now? And what might be an obstacle in achieving any of that? And once you get grounded in that, it's easier to then look at, okay, now I can take this idea and think about, well, what is it I want the story to be able to do? And how do I make sure I can work the process through that? So first step is start with your audience and get really clear on who they are, because that's going to change each time. And that's going to impact the outcome that you want to have on your story.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a helpful shift. And is that after you understand the difference of the types of stories, or is that just kind of part of the process?
To me, that's
no matter the type of story.
Yeah, to me, that's the starting point. From there, once you pick an idea for a story, I use a 4-part story structure that is applicable in any situation. And so it's not a structure like the hero's journey where you have to force it in. It provides truly a skeleton that you can build different things on. You can order it in different ways and play with it to make it fit for whatever setting you have. So you're going to ask yourself 4 questions or write out 4 responses. And it's for the context, the conflict, the outcome, and the takeaway. So the context is, what is the setting of the story? Who's involved, and why should the audience care? You want to be able to write a sentence or two for that to help ground in what that is. Mm-hmm. The conflict is, you know, what is the conflict? What happens where everything changes? This is the fuel of the story. When you run out of conflict, you run out of story. This is the thing to be resolved. The outcome is, what is the action taken as a result of the conflict? What happens because of it? And then the takeaway is the thing that most people don't do. It is the, what is the idea, the thesis, the theme, the big thing that we want the audience coming away thinking? And so if you take any idea that you have and start to map out, what is this context of the setting and why the audience should care? What's the conflict, the tension to be resolved? What is the outcome? What's the result of that tension? And then what is the takeaway of this? You can pair that with the what you've defined for your audience and start to make sure, am I getting this to what I wanted the audience to know, think, feel, or do? That won't give you the perfect story. It's truly a skeleton, but it lets you start to get the building blocks of, do I have the right elements in place? Does it look like I've thought through the big pieces of this? Because then you build and add on the different things that will really help engage the brain.
Hmm.
So you have a story, but what you might work with your clients on is that they take that story and now with that formula, they build out the story instead of it just being like, so I feel like that might be the answer to the question of how you help people become better storytellers is even just through having that formula.
It's correct? Yeah, it's layered, right? Because there's always an opportunity to go deeper, myself included. But when we're starting, yeah, you define your audience, you get really clear on the structure. And then the next layer is how you start to build out each of those pieces, how you add in elements that are going to engage the brain around the senses, emotions. And then you get to, what's the best way to sequence this story? What's going to really put it in a way where it's going to capture my attention and not allow me to make too many assumptions about where it's going to go? How do I play with that? Sometimes there's a piece of it that's storytelling with data, like you mentioned, of how do I tell stories with data? And then it gets to, okay, when I've worked out all of those pieces, how do I bring my body into this as I'm telling it and make that be part of the story too? So you can really keep going through different pieces depending on what the person's looking to do.
Karen, I'm curious about so one of the struggles I have with this is not just feeling like, oh, you need to do the origin story. And the first time we were talking, you said origin stories don't matter. I love that. I actually wrote it down. I've been thinking about it because it's like, yes, I needed that kind of permission slip. But then beyond that, I still always feel the need to say all the things. And so if
like
you're telling
too many
a story,
details?
Too many details, or just like if you leave something out, they're gonna misunderstand. And you actually made a comment that was really helpful for me there too, that you don't need to tell all the things. Like actually you have permission not to tell all the things because the small stories give you permission to tell more. I wonder if you could kind of speak to that as well.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a roundabout route. What happens when you're listening to someone recount a dream of theirs? What is that experience like for either of you when you hear someone be like, let me tell you about the dream I had last night?
I'm in. I just want to know.
Yeah. And is there describing all of the details? Can you follow it all? Are all the details relevant to you?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of want just, I mean, my personality just kind of wants to not go into all the like, and then I was asleep and then I was awake and then I was asleep and then I was awake. And then it's more like there was water, you know, I kind of want themes.
Completely. Because it wasn't your dream. And they're not going to tell it in a way that makes you feel like you have the same experience they did. And so part of the reason why you don't have to tell every single little thing that you're afraid you're going to leave out is like, I don't want to hear every detail in your dream. I'm sorry. Yeah. I want to hear about your dream. I'm in. Tell me. But please don't tell me where you're describing like every single corner of what you envisioned. And so a little bit of the same is true when you're telling a story. You want to be mindful that what you're telling is meaningful or relevant to the audience. And when we're recounting things about our own experiences, our tendency is to want to share so much because we lived it. Like, you have an emotional connection to it, and I want to give that same connection to you, but probably you don't need quite as much as what meant something to me. So I always say, keep that in mind of, you know, part of the storytelling process is editing, and is this really adding the value that's needed for the audience, or can it be cut because it just means something to me? When you do tell a story, it does earn you permission to tell more stories. They have compounding interest. And so, you know, for entrepreneurs or people that are starting up different projects and things, that there's this pressure or this feeling of like, I have to tell the story that's going to justify why I'm doing this and invite you in. And there's rarely one story that does all that. Rarely, you know.
So taking the pressure off of the one story.
Right.
And putting it on
moments
that there's many stories.
Yeah.
And also, who knows what story resonates with what person and what audience?
Completely. Too? And when you do a little bit of the audience work, you tend to at least make an educated guess of what direction to go in. But it's the small moments that are going to grab someone. So if you've ever been influenced to buy something off of social media or Amazon or whatever, it's not the all-encompassing, whole, complete solution. It's like the pain point that it solves. It's the, one of my friends calls it the punch him in the bruise, right? It's that thing that you're like, oh, I know I need to deal with this. And I just keep forgetting to. When you tell stories about these things, that's what people connect with, because those are the things that they're having the emotions about, the aspirations toward, the frustrations around. And so that small story can be more impactful than one diluted story. And the reason that you don't need the origin story is that I find that two things. One is, as you mentioned, there wasn't a moment. You know, some people are like, please tell me the moment that told you that this is what you were meant to do. And for a lot of people, there isn't. Like, the moment is none of the above. I don't want to do what I was doing. I want to do something else. People ask because they're just trying to make sense of your journey, but you don't have to have a moment. There doesn't have to be this profound thing. That doesn't make you any less able or celebrated in what you do. But also, whatever reason you started with is not what you're the same reason why you're doing it today. So a very diluted example is Amazon started out as a bookseller. If they were telling their origin story, like, who cares? You know, great, you're a bookseller. That's nice, but you're so much more than that now. And we're not all Amazons, but I find in my business, it changes quarterly. And trying to tell the origin story doesn't matter. It's selfish. It's about me and my past versus putting you in the center as the audience of the things you're facing and struggling with and what you're trying to do. So the now story, the where we're going, the things I can help you with, that's so much more meaningful and not selfish.
Yeah, I'm also fascinated with how it ties in with culture. I mean, how did it lead to, how did you end up doing what you're doing now? When did this shift into more culture leadership? I mean, I know you said you're using story to influence people in your role, but now you're more bringing that into cultural development. Is that right?
Yeah, it really was. As most people, as your roles are expanding and you move up through your career, you take on different scope. And so I went from training projects to career path to looking at the whole employee life cycle and how are you creating engagement for employees and getting beyond just the learning and development, but really what is that environment that we're creating and how are you shaping culture and how do you make that be meaningful to people? What are you giving them to have that be helpful? And so it continued to grow and grow and grow. And I just, through actually happenstance, had a story that I shared that there were a couple, but they were always the ones that always really took off were ones that had to do with struggle and how someone was treated and ultimately feeling seen and recognized and feeling valued when they had themes like that. And they took off and spread globally. And then people were talking about it and that led them to have discussions. And so I realized like it's such a great way to get to all employees and help them think about what things mean.
Yeah. You, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, were involved with kind of building some of the early stages of performance management system structures, approaches, yes, right?
My apologies. Yeah. So when I was when I was at Deloitte, we were looking at how to build one of the first ratings-free performance management and how do we rethink this. And this was the same thing of as I started to look at the environment employees were in and culture, you cannot look at culture without looking at performance management. It's probably the biggest reinforcer of it because it's what's rewarded. It's how you're assessed. It's something that touches everyone. And we believed, and other companies were starting to look at it at that time too, there has to be a different way to do this. The forced bell curve and ratings and all the things that leave people coming away depleted aren't developing anyone. And in fact, they're causing harm when you look at some of the research. Mm-hmm. So what if we were really trying to develop people, or what if we were really trying to do this different?
Yeah, I was just pausing there because I agree. Do you feel like some companies are still so resistant to moving away from that 1, 2, 3 and or out the door?
They are. It's funny. I did a research project not that long ago talking to different companies to understand where is performance management today. And I thought more people, more organizations would be in this continuous performance management, meaning that it wasn't so much you get your goals cascaded at the first part of the year and then you have your mid-year and your year end, that it was more focused on the ongoing conversations and the coaching and the feedback. But what we found is there were still so many in this very traditional approach. And what happens in the ones where you move to the continuous is in the traditional approach as a leader, as a manager, if I sit down with you to set goals and we have a mid-year conversation and we have a year-end conversation, I know I've done my job. Now, you and I know, like, absolutely not. No, you haven't. Three conversations a year is not enough for anyone. But to them, it was like, I get it. I've done what's expected of me. What companies struggle with the continuous is they say, well, how often should I be talking to employees? And you're like, well, you need to sit down with the employee and figure that out. You need to be checking in on their goals and talking about their work and talking about what they need. And so maybe that's every week. Maybe that's every other week. Maybe that's once a month. That's up to you to figure out. And all of a sudden, they don't know what to do.
Right.
And well, so many don't have the guidance in how to do feedback or difficult discussions or coaching. And so that's where I think the systems falter of, it's not that they don't want to do it. It's that they're just paralyzed, not knowing what that could be, how it could be different.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you're similar to us in how we want to be proactive with everything, because the reactive is kind of what you're describing, where then an organization says, okay, so what's the latest trick or tool or tech we can use to fix this? And I always feel this pit in my stomach because you can't say this, but you kind of want to say this. Like, it's actually too late if that's what you're looking for. It needed to be in the day-to-day, how managers and leaders interact with people in the day-to-day, the stuff that's actually just very, like, do it over and over and over.
100%.
It's no different than how we define regular culture or regular relationships or families. Like, the culture of it is like the vibe of the day-to-day interactions. And yet in companies, it's like, we want to ignore all that, not pay attention to the day-to-day interactions, and then say, okay, so what kind of, like, tool can I slap onto this to fix the performance problems?
Well, it's never technology. It's always the behaviors, right? And that's the challenge. All of the companies that panicked when we moved to a hybrid or virtual working environment in 2020 were saying, our culture is going to erode. And they didn't get the fact that your culture is not within walls. It's in interactions and conversations. And the ones that struggled before 2020, they just didn't recognize it. You know, I feel like we're at this reckoning of leadership development, where all of this return to office is part real estate decision, but it's also part we are designing work to the lowest common denominator, which is the manager that doesn't have the tools to lead teams in different ways. And so that's also not doing work service, because
because we're too busy doing the tasks of the work versus, back to the beginning of our conversation, designing the interactions of, all right, this is how we should interact in the day-to-day. So it'll naturally create those kind of, like, good cultural results that we want.
Right.
It's almost a reactive. I like the way you put it. We're designing for the lowest common denominator because it's by accident.
And if you don't adjust that, those companies will always be stunted in their growth, their ability to attract talent, to deliver results. You know, those that were smart were already doing these things, or they recognize this is a moment for us to think differently about how we're doing this.
Hmm.
So what's the typical kind of team that might hire you? Like what are they looking for?
For work like that
you
do.
Come in and yeah, for the work you do.
Yeah, it's twofold. So storytelling is an obvious one where there's companies that recognize this is not just a fun skill. It is really a skill that can help connect teams, that can help in different client interactions or customer interactions. So it's everything from working with leaders individually to I have a team where we do different workshops, taking people through how do you get better at storytelling, including storytelling with data and actually physically delivering stories. And then the other part is holding on to my culture and leadership work. I will often come and do work with leadership teams, unpacking conflict, building trust, learning how to work together more effectively and address the problems they have.
Mm-hmm. Very clear.
Do you want to do a real life example where we work on a story real time to demonstrate how you can take a story and break through to get to something that feels meaningful?
I think that'd be cool.
Okay.
Do you?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I'm down. Mm-hmm. We'll do real time fun here.
Okay.
So I love it.
I want you to think of a story that, let's see, something that you have in mind that has created a shift in your work or a big aha, I don't want to say a big aha moment because I just said we didn't
have
it.
No, it's okay. I think I have it. Yeah.
Okay. Give us a sentence on what you're thinking of for your story.
Okay. So what I'm thinking is I've actually changed quite a bit recently to having a more paced schedule. Whereas it used to feel very stressed and overwhelmed all the time. Like I could never get the to-do list done. There's always more to do than there's time for. And that's not what I experience anymore most of the time, which is a huge shift. Of course, it's internal, right? Like not many people see that, but I feel that. That's been a big change lately.
Okay. And I'm sure that everyone listening is nodding their head saying, yes. Yeah.
Everyone has some version of that,
so
right?
So before we start... Okay. Tell us a little bit about your thought process of this. What feels easy about this topic and what feels hard? Because I want to show that probably what you're thinking is the same thing as what other people are thinking when they go through stories.
Well, that's why this is so helpful. Yeah. Okay. What's easy about it is, most people are busy and stressed and overwhelmed, at least people listening to this. So that seems kind of like a normal thing. And it's easy to say, like, I've changed that. What feels hard is that there's a thousand things that have played into that shift. So as I think about telling that story, I'm immediately paralyzed because I'm like, I can't tell them all, but which one do I focus on? And then if I leave some out, then I'm not being true to the story. I just don't know where to go with it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Because I'm sure other people feel that in their stories too. A comment on that before we dig in. First, there's two ways off the top of my head to play it. One is you just pick one because you already acknowledge this whole topic is something that's so familiar to people. You just need like one or two really specific examples to mm-hmm. bring it to life. And there doesn't have to be this big definitive moment that made it happen. The second mm-hmm. is you approach it as, you know, there really wasn't one defining moment where this happened. It was accumulation of little things like, and you give an example of like one.
Just kind of naming that there wasn't one big moment.
Either way. So take us through, do you want to do the context conflict outcome? Like take us through the context of the story.
I'll dive in. Sure. Oh man, this is fun. All right. So the context is I always kind of have more ambition than there is room for in the day. Meaning, like growing up, my mom would always say, you always put more on your plate than you can eat. Like, especially if we went to some kind of all-you-can-eat thing. I'm like definitely choosing more items than I can actually eat. So clearly I'm bad with like analogies. What is it?
No, you're good. That's a good specific one. But we're starting to get into the
your appetite is bigger than
your eyes are bigger than your plate.
Eyes
there it is. Your eyes are bigger than your appetite. Your appetite. That's what I was trying to say.
Your appetite's bigger than your eyes.
It's okay.
Your appetite is bigger than your face.
My guidance is to avoid the like expressions and idioms. It's always better to use your own words because it's more
really?
Unique. Yeah.
I get them right.
Well, then I'm
going to
be I'm an amazing storyteller already.
Okay, but we're starting to get into conflict. So part of it is you want to do more than you have time for. How has that shown up as conflict for you?
Well, because the end of every workday in particular, I would feel this kind of low-grade anxiety of like, okay, time to leave, but there's all these things that still need to get done. I would always want to like finish out the things before I end the day. Yep. But that's impossible.
Okay.
I don't know that I've ever done that.
So, and we're still kind of outlining, so I'm going to keep moving forward because we'll come back and have you do a full pass after.
Okay, so got it.
Then we get to outcome. How would you summarize... Mm-hmm. And you get to make the choice here. This is probably where you start to put in the there wasn't one moment, it was this or this, or you pick one of them. Play with either. What did you do and what happened?
I like that second one because it kind of names the thing I always struggle with. So so there wasn't one particular moment where this all changed, but there has been a defined shift. And I feel like most days recently, I feel more paced and more at peace with the stuff I did get done and the stuff that hasn't gotten done. I do think there was one of those pieces that started making the shift was the need to do more creative and strategic work. So in my role, more than ever, I have to do basically only creative and strategic work and never like discrete tasks. And so the only way I've found, at least, to be able to get that kind of work done is if I have huge chunks of time. And for me, it tends to look like 2 to 4 hours or more. Like I have to have these big chunks of uninterrupted time, which I guess just started forcing me to, I actually have to kind of like block out time and not do all these other little things. It's the only way I can get that big stuff done. And, you know, my income and many other people's income depends on getting those big things done. So maybe that was the, you know, the pressure point. I guess that was one of the things that started to help me create more of a pace on my calendar, more of a time is organized and things are allotted certain times instead of just this giant overwhelming to-do list that there's never going to be enough time in the day.
When did you know you were making momentum on it?
I knew I was making momentum when multiple Mondays in a row, I had nothing on my calendar and I woke up and looked at it and was like, all right, I can get this done. And then at the end of that, those Mondays actually got like a meaningful, big, like item of work done.
And give us a takeaway.
So the moral of the story is,
you could almost frame the takeaway as like how you would advise someone.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I was going with it too. So I think the takeaway is look at your calendar with a fresh lens and try to approach the way you organize your time different, because if you can create bigger blocks of time, it might start to force you into a better pace and rhythm versus organizing your day by having a giant to-do list that you can never get done.
Yeah.
And see, even in saying that, I feel the tension because I'm like, well, that's not the full story. That's not really like everything that changed for me, but that was a significant piece of it.
So
I guess is
when you tell the story, what is the outcome you want for the audience?
Well, I do know a lot of people like me are looking for more focus, are looking for more sense of accomplishment in their work and fulfillment. And yet they're so stressed out and overwhelmed all the time. Like they don't even have time to think about this question, let alone change anything.
So one thing I would love for you to embrace, and I'll come back on the story, the feeling you have of like, I haven't fully given you everything. Like I feel like I haven't done that. That's actually a selfish thought, because if you give everything, you're not leaving me enough space to have my own story. You're just telling me what to do.
Yeah.
And part of it is you want to give enough so that I can hear it and think of my own experiences and be like, yep, oh, I got it. Oh, clear Monday. That's really interesting. I'd been clearing Fridays. So it's okay not to be able to not express every single thing you have because you want to leave space for everyone to have their own internal dialogue if that's freeing in any way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad you said that because I often feel the opposite. I feel like I'm doing a disservice to the listener if I don't tell them all the pieces of it, right? Like, oh, I'm leaving something out that they need. So that's actually a helpful kind of reframing of it.
When you're interviewing guests, do you prefer the guest that gives you every single possible answer to the question, or do you prefer the guest that gives a slightly shorter answer that you can then ask follow-ups and dig in where is most helpful?
Right. Of course, the shorters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same. We don't want to hear about your dream in detail.
But don't you care? My dreams are awesome.
Oh, no. I'm just trying to free you of the burden. So if we had, you know, a lot more time, we would keep working through the story. But as I'm listening to you, the way I would start playing with that is I might start with a question. Because remember, the story starts with the audience. So you want to connect with people that are struggling with, do you like keep running out of time? Do you just rewrite your to-do list every day? Or, you know, whatever. You ask a couple of questions and be like, hi, welcome to the club. I have been a member. I'm also the owner since whatever. In fact, my mom described me as having my eyes too big for my plate and food and life or whatever I tried to do. I always want to take on more than I can. So I'm telling it in the order of context, conflict, outcome, takeaway. You could change it all around. If you had like one specific story, you could start right at the conflict. But I might start, you know, make that joke, and then I would go into here's the problem that was creating for me in the conflict. Here's what wasn't getting done. Here's how it was impacting my life. And it kept falling into the thing that I should deal with, but I couldn't figure out how to deal with it. There wasn't one defining moment that made me wake up and say, this is going to be different. It was, insert specific example, you know, it was recognizing that I didn't have any time to do creative things and that was impacting here. And it was recognizing livelihood. And then I tried this, right? So you're starting to see how we're threading it. What I'm doing in this process is I keep thinking of the audience. And so what you're trying to do is relate this back to them and their struggles and their pain points and where you're trying to get them to. We want really specific moments in here because they're going to be memorable. Like, I knew it was a problem on the day that I was supposed to, I don't know, cash the check and I didn't, and, you know, what, like, pick a really specific thing. Because then you're inviting us into that story and you're helping us see what it could be. You could even start the conflict, and I'm making up this check cashing thing because it's just what came to my head. I'm standing at the bank and I don't know, my funds are overdrawn or I couldn't cash the check when I needed to. And that's when I realized I had a problem.
And it's really freeing that tool of just naming the fact that there were lots of things that played into it. You know, there were 100 different moments that kind of led to this new way of approaching work.
Give us two, for example, really specific
was
ones.
Because
it's that specificity that's going to catch our attention because it's unexpected. If you glossed over it and you just said, you know, there wasn't any one thing, there were so many things and I just got so sick of myself. Like, no, tell us the day that you felt really sick of yourself. It doesn't have to be the big momentous moment, but that is going to, I couldn't lie in bed another night, like hating myself for not whatever or what, you know, whatever. The specificity is going to catch the attention. And then your example of like, I knew it was working when I had this Monday and it was clear. It's then connecting people to different things.
That's so helpful to like see it in action and play around with it. This has been fascinating. I think there's a number of topics we could go down for even more time, but tell people about just your book and where they can connect with you further.
I am trying to do something a little bit different in this book because there's certainly a lot out there on storytelling, but I don't feel like there's much that gets into science and some of the new research that says what's happening in your brain. But more importantly, what do you actually then do with that? How do you factor that into the story. And so while that makes it sound like I'm lining you up for a science lecture, it is not. It is definitely this relatable way to recognize that there's certain things that are going to catch our brain to pay attention, and there's certain things that are going to make it tune out. And so I walk through these, I call them the five factory settings of the brain, and how you can use them when you're building a story is like these different levers to consider on where you want your story to go. It takes you through the process of finding, building, and telling your stories, how to tell stories with data, even how to give a toast or a eulogy. And it's good fun.
What's the title?
Yeah, that would be helpful, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's called The Perfect Story, How to Tell Stories That Inform, Influence, and Inspire. And it's a bit of a play on words. The last line of my TED Talk is, don't wait for the perfect story. Take your stories and make them perfect.
Yeah. So also, what's the title of your TED Talk if people just want to watch there?
I don't know. Do you know?
Oh, God. Should I just look up your name?
Yeah. We'll have the link in the show.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't name it. So I don't, it's had a couple different names. So I think it's What Stories Do in Your Brain and Why They're Essential for Leaders, something like that. But yeah, it's under my name. Mm-hmm. I'm not a good representative of that.
Well, thanks for hanging out with us, Karen.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.